So we'll begin this evening with the instructions and a 30-minute meditation. And I will review the instructions of the previous 2 weeks. And each week I will start the meditation with an inclusive instruction that builds upon the previous weeks, but I also review the previous weeks as we enter this one. And each time I talk about the instructions, I'll add another dimension for our awareness, another dimension to open to for that week's meditation. So whatever instructions we do tonight, please include those into your week's meditation. So if we could start by taking a straight posture. And just remind those who are sitting in chairs that the feet should be flat on the floor, and if you can, the back should be not leaning against the back of the chair, but swung outward so that it's free and independent of the back of the seat. And for those of us who are on the floor, finding a posture which allows the back to be bowed somewhat and the shoulders to be unrounded. And if we could just close our eyes. And as we attempt to do each week at this time, leaving the rest of the day's activities at the door as we enter, so that we allow all of the different problems or dangling conversations to recede in memory, so that as soon as we release ourselves from the dwelling on the past or the future, we find that there's only one place where our awareness unfolds, and that's in the present moment. So automatically, in unwinding, suddenly you feel the senses become alive and awake. So soften the mind. You can feel the mind, just soften it. Soften the eyes. Loosening the jaw. And dropping the shoulders away from the neck. And allowing our belly to move effortlessly with each inhalation and falling on each exhalation. And if it's helpful to just begin to notice that movement and labeling it very quietly, rising, falling, rising, falling. And this tethers our mind to the body. What we'll find is that the mind takes flight very quickly in thought. And if we have a tether to the body, since the body is always here and now, that tether will bring us back to the here and now if we open ourselves up to the sensations of the body. So as the mind gets lost in thought, which it will countless times, remember, first of all, that you are not at fault for losing reference to the breath. So that takes a burden off of you right there. Your only job is whenever you do realize that, and that can be several minutes down the line, releasing yourself from that thought and just being willing first to go back to the body and the sense of relaxation and ease. And then allowing the breath to emerge from that sense of physical ease and well-being. So that was the first week's instructions. The second week, we introduced and opened the field of our attention to include other physical sensations besides that of just the breath. So that if while we were sitting, a competing physical sensation should predominate over the breath so that it called our attention from the breath, then we could go to that competing physical sensation with the same degree of focus we were giving the breath. Not trying or waiting for it to end so that I can get back to the breath, but bringing a whole and complete meditation to that competing sensation, be it a pleasant one or an unpleasant one. Feelings of heat or cold or tingling, or touch of the breeze on our body, or itching, or perhaps most predominantly pain. If we can rest our attention at that competing sensation, just relaxing and releasing any tension we might have in response to pain or an itch. And so it's very important to take our relaxed pose with an unpleasant sensation like pain and just begin to include it within the mind so that we know that it's unpleasant, but we're not trying to drive it out of the equation of the here and now. We're just permitting it to be there, expressing itself in whatever way it is. And when it becomes less predominant, we can then go back to the breath. And if it becomes so predominant that it creates a inward crisis of fear and contraction, then it's better just to change the posture, rub the sore place and begin again. We never make a mistake in the sense that it never defeats us, because we can always begin again. The magic of the practice is that no matter what has occurred, no matter how poorly we were up to the task at hand, we can always begin again. And in that beginning again is ultimate forgiveness. Because if we bring nothing to the beginning again, then there's been no history. And we're free to be alive and awake and as inclusive as we possibly can be, regardless of how it is that we were with that particular sensation in the past. We can always begin again. That's ultimately the salvation of the practice, because it can never defeat us. We can always begin again. This week, we're going to open the field of our attention to include emotions. So that if while you're sitting, an emotion should come to bear, either pleasant emotion, like feelings of well-being, happiness, bliss, joy, or unpleasant emotions, like anger, fear, irritation, annoyance, we again can take our mind off the breath and place it on the physical sensations that are accompanying that emotion. Now there will be a content layer to that emotion, an explanation or a memory of why it is that you feel the way you're feeling. Don't dwell upon that, for that is thought, and we don't want to go there and encourage or dig up the emotion's content. We just let the content be. We focus in on the mind state, how the emotion feels texturally, the texture of it, and also where we feel it in the body. Usually most emotions are felt in the heart area. And what we try to do is just in make our awareness inclusive enough so that regardless of what emotion we're feeling, it has an appropriateness, an inclusibility within the sphere of our attention. So we're not trying to get rid of one emotion and bring forth another. We're not trying to do or rearrange any of our inward life whatsoever. We're just letting the whole train of events pass by. And we're on the tracks watching the train car by car. And you will find that each sensation, as it arises, will eventually pass away. And so will the emotions that we feel so enslaved to. Their intensity will change, their duration will change. And you become very settled and very secure in the sense that no matter how bad it is, it's going to change. And this is an insight into one of the laws, the fundamental laws of nature, which is that every experience has a duration and an intensity and lasts only that long. And so it's only that much. It's no more than that. And the worst thing an emotion can make you do is feel it. What we're afraid of is if we open to it, we will begin to act it out in some kind of animalistic way. But if we're willing to feel it just for what it is, it has no more control on us than our willingness to feel it. Be sure to bring the relaxed mind and body to the emotion so that the emotion doesn't set a charge of anxiety and fear off with it, which is a secondary emotion to it. So when we're relaxed or feeling angry, we just relax with it. Okay, I can feel this. Remember the mantra, I can feel this. I can feel this. No matter what the feeling is, we have the capacity to hold. And what I mean by that, the capacity to let the feeling be. And it comes and it goes. And then when it goes, we can go back to the breath or whatever is the next most predominant sensation in our attention. But we always have somewhere to go because the breath is always occurring, even if emotions and more predominant sensations are not. So if nothing in particular has happened, we rest our attention upon the breath. It's helpful sometimes to label the emotion very quickly and very gently with whatever the first word that comes up is. Anger, anger, fear, fear, joy, joy. But don't dig out the word because we're not interested so much in words. We're interested in the experience, and whatever you're experiencing is fine. And we rest with that. We receive our inward life. We don't lean into our inward life. The sense of receptiveness, settling back and allowing the experience to come to us. And we are the passive observer of that experience for the duration of our meditation. And now I'll be quiet and we'll sit for the next 15 minutes. So I'll end the sitting with a poem, The Guest House by Rumi. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if there are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be cleaning you out for some new delight. The dark thoughts, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whomever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. May all beings be at ease with their emotional life. May all beings allow their emotions to run their course without identification or judgment. May all beings see that everything changes internally and externally. So you're welcome to stand up and stretch if you'd like. We're intentionally keeping it dark in here tonight because I'm going to use a flashlight as my prop for the talk. So bear with us, and for those who are listening to this as a tape, I'll try to explain what I'm doing as I'm doing it. Everyone picked up a direction to the blue paper, the direction to the day long, and also one of the white papers, which were the homework for next week. Okay, if we get people to sit up and not lie down for the Dharma talk, it's as important to be alert for this as it is for the meditation. It's not time off, so to speak. And I'd like to present the talk tonight as a metaphor, and the room that we're in, I'm going to use as an analogy for our mind, each one of our minds. And we're going to enter the room of our minds. And so I'm going to use the flashlight as a depiction of our attention or awareness within the room of the mind. Now, first we have to ask why we would even enter this room. I got a note one time on a retreat from a yogi. Someone who sits in a meditation retreat is called a yogi. And he said, or she said, I treat my mind like a bad neighborhood. I try not to go there alone. I think most of us have a mistrusting and somewhat distant and perhaps tinged with respect for what might be in this room of the mind. And we hear all kinds of horror stories about unconscious and shadows and subconscious tendencies and the id and the super. I mean, good Lord, when you enter this thing, maybe we should all do it with armor. Because God knows what will come out pouring from those doors as we open ourselves to the room. But unfortunately, we've tried not living in the room. We've tried living at the expense of the room. We've tried to do everything so that we won't have to come in here and take responsibility. But eventually, the symptoms by which we live call our attention to the problem, which is in the room. And some of those symptoms might be our projections that we put on people and places. What we do is we take a tendency in ourselves that we don't like because it's in the room, in our room, and we project it outside of ourselves and place it on someone else. And then we look at that tendency, which we don't like in ourselves, and then we learn to dislike it in the other person, and that's called prejudice, be it skin color or sexual orientation. It's all from the same place. And we have tried to blame away our emotions and point our fingers to other people for the responsibility for having the emotion. And as I might have mentioned, that only takes us so far because, for instance, if I'm angry and I say that you make me angry, all I have to do is eliminate you and my anger is resolved. And thereby we create the intention or the direction or the rationale for murder, be it war or a dismissive attitude to someone, which is also a type of murder, a negation, not listening to him, just... Right. So at some point, when we're at all alert, and when we have some degree of understanding and sophistication and experience in life, we begin to understand that we aren't going to find the problems originating outside of ourselves. And this is a huge step. I really am wondrous that anyone ever comes to this step. But, in fact, some of us do. And we might have framed it like, why did you come to meditation, which I asked all of you on the first night we were together. Many of you framed it in terms of wanting something extra that seems to be missing in your life, and you don't know how else to find it but by entering this room. So we may come with different motivations for entering it, but most of us feel like the sense of completion or wholeness or connection lies in this thing, and I just have to learn how to manage it. So we come in. Now, how we enter the room is as important as that we enter the room. How we enter the room. Because the dynamics, the laws that operate in this room here are far different than the laws and the dynamics and the strategies that we have employed in our life when we haven't looked inwardly. So we have to come in very lightly. If we come in with a lot of baggage, and baggage would be in the form of a lot of opinions or self-judgment, self-hatred, self-dislike, inadequacy, a readiness to condemn anything you see in here and judge it. And well, we're going to come into this room very laden and heavy and probably complicate the internal component of this room through our judgment. So we have to come in very lightly, very lightly. So we come in with one thing and one thing only. And at this point, I turn on the flashlight. We come in with the light of our attention, with the light of our awareness. It's so light, you can't feel it on your body, can you? As I shine the light on each one of you, you can't even feel it hitting you. It's that light. It's that innocent. It's that gentle. You see, we come into the room with the one quality of heart, because this is heart, that allows things to be revealed without being reviled. We come in without our judgment. We come in just with the bare attention of our awareness. And we begin to shine it throughout the landscape, the environment of this inward chamber, the room of our mind. And we are told to place our attention upon our breath. And let's say that that particular spot that I'm shining on now is our breath. And we're asked to hold our attention, which is the light, on our breath. And many of us come in and we think, I can do that. And it's like this. We don't even know we're not paying attention. Oh, my breath. I'm supposed to be on my breath. Oh, okay. One breath and then off. Yesterday was such a great day. God, today was kind of cloudy. And well, you know, I'm going to see that person today in the office. And oh, my breath. Okay, my breath. Well, maybe I just won't go back on my breath. Maybe I would rather just... The breath is boring. What do I want to come back here? Okay, in breath, out breath. In breath, out breath, in breath. Does it sound familiar? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That is the truth. That's the way we all do it. And you know, everyone who ever meditated that I know of started this way. Every single one of us. You're not disadvantaged. Disabled. You're not. This is the way everyone is oriented. This is the way everyone has perpetuated the themes of their life. This is, we haven't really been willing or able to turn on the light. The light is out for the tape. However, oh well. Check the batteries, right. Okay, so play around with it. Okay, so without the light as my prop, I will still usher in the talk. Now, look as I point my hand to the right side of the room. We think what we would like to do is sort of hang out in the pleasant areas of this space. We'd like to go up into the right-hand corner where there is some silence, some quietness. We think that there's a little bit of joy, parts of ourselves, of our mind state that we most enjoy. We sort of like to hang out in that area. And we like to draw a big steel curtain to barricade ourselves from anything we don't like. And we hold back and we try to resist anything in the room that at all intimates any part of our self-consciousness or our persona or our roles in which are in which show us in a disfavorable light. And we're actually trying to resist any aspect of ourselves, certainly emotionally those components which indicate that I might have some anger or greed or passion, lust, right? So we work a lot and a long time on trying to isolate parts of the room from other parts that we like. The problem is, you can't do it. The problem is that it's impossible to do. It's all one room. And it contains the whole continuum of a human mind. All of the different qualities, you're not any different than any other human being that walked. Your content may be different and probably is, and your proportion of different states of mind might be quite different than others. You may be happier or sadder than some people, but you hold the whole continuum of the human consciousness within you, as every single person does. And what we do by mistake is to try to think that we can be special and cultivate just certain qualities and then enrich those qualities and hold everything else in abeyance. And when we do that, we create the shadow for those things that we dislike in ourselves on that continuum, because they will show up. Remember, it's a single room. And not only is it a single room, but you're locked in it. You can't get out. So when we realize that the very resistance we have to something, like anger, means that every time anger arises in us, which it will, though we meet it with a strong aversive tendency, which gives it greater charge, and actually creates a more of a cast and a hold upon us because of our reaction to it. And we also have a fear response to anger when it might arise for whatever reasons we have in the past seen people who have been out of control in their anger and have hurt people. And so when that arises in us and we have a parental history in which that has occurred, that has another charge to it. And so when it comes up in me, we get frightened. And we think, okay, well, I've got to change the subject. I've got to do something. I've got to make myself lighter. I've got to see a therapist. I have to do something. And each one of us have a whole degree and range of the continuum in which we are happy and we can live very comfortably, And then when moods change, which they inevitably will, because that's the nature of this mind, is that it's in flow. It's not static. You can't create a certain quality in this room and have it last very long at all. It'll last for a while and then it'll end, no matter how much effort and energy you put in cultivating that quality, and how much resistance you put in holding back other aspects of yourself from your attention. So you can feel the edge, the edginess that the mind has within each one of us. Can't you? This is really how it is. Now last week, we brought up a preliminary lesson that was essential for even wanting to come into this room. And that is that facts are friendly. Facts, what it is that's occurring in my mind is an inward fact. What it is that I'm feeling, what it is that I'm thinking, what it is that the attitude I'm holding, those are all momentary facts of my existence in that moment. Now let's apply the preliminary lesson of last week to being in this room today. Facts, my anger, is friendly. How can my anger be friendly? It's not friendly as long as I reference it with my judgment. As long as I reference it with having seen people hurt other people from it. As long as I come and approach my anger from fear, it's not friendly, because I'm not seeing anger for what it is. I'm seeing it colored through my past and projection and my projection onto what anger is in this moment. Oh, I see. That's just like what my father did to me, and I can't. This is not a safe emotion. Now, it may not be anger that is your resonance here. But each one of you have an emotion, which is grief. If you've had a history of depression, sadness. If you have been very isolated in your life and felt cut off, loneliness, despair. Okay. So how can those facts possibly be friendly? If we are in this room of the mind with all of those facts, and we begin to see that shielding ourselves from any of those facts does not serve our own growth. In fact, they just complicate and charge the inward world of this room with a great deal of turmoil and terror and fear and all of the things that psychology has so richly described in terms of the unconscious and subconscious. Things are subconscious or unconscious merely because we are unwilling to perceive them. Our awareness is not subtle enough yet to be able or willing to approach those things. They aren't some hidden layer that are unreachable. Or we could never awaken fully to this room. In fact, what you will find as you meditate is that the subconscious becomes conscious. And the images contained in it become the images by which we will sit with for many months or years. So it is our approach that will determine whether something is safe or not. It is how we approach something. And this is a very, very important point when we enter this room. Remember, I said we had to enter it without judgment. Because the judgment isn't coming from outside this room. The judgment is coming from in this room. We just think that it's coming from outside. By discerning something as an object, and then we place judgment upon it. But the judgment is coming from here, in here. Where else could it be coming from? So when we enter the room and we're angry, and suddenly we are annoyed that we are angry, can't you see that you're actually fanning the fires of the anger through your annoyance and your attitude towards the anger itself? That your upsetness about being angry is actually cultivating more anger. And therefore, that doesn't work. It doesn't work to bring the same charge. I'm afraid of my fear. I'm annoyed at my irritation. I'm depressed because I'm sad. It doesn't work to bring the same component to the room because it just charges that component up even more. So what do? We come in very lightly. We bring our attention to bear and look at the room. Okay, we look at that thing with just the lightness of our attention, adding nothing more than the lightness of our attention. Now, this is so, it's so simple and so beautiful. There's a law in science called the law, I think it's called the law of parsimony or parsimony, which a scientific fact is so elegant and so absolutely perfect in its precision of how it holds the truth that it has to be true by that very sense. This is also that elegant. We just bring the light of our attention to bear upon whatever it is that's going on in this room. Because then we open it up. First, we're not to our judgments, so we're never judging what is in here. We're just seeing what is in here. Inward seeing. Remember that we're doing insight meditation, sight into meditation. So we bring the lamp of our attention, which is the only thing that we have and the only thing we need. What do we think Christ meant when he said, "Stay forever awake, for the kingdom of God is at hand"? We bring that forever wakefulness, that attention, to bear upon whatever it is that's going on in our attention. Our anger, our sorrow, our grief, our loneliness, our happiness, our joy, we shine it on that. And we do so, we don't smother it. We don't create a climate for it to have or contain or be encrusted in fear. We just see it for what it is. In fact, there is nothing that the mind can come up with that you can't or do not have the capacity to hold, to allow to be just as it is. I don't mean hold on, I mean allow things to be just as it is. No matter what arises within us, it's only the fear we have of something which gives it any hold over us whatsoever. And if we just see something for what it is with our attention and just allow it to be what it is, it will come within this room, within the continuum of the humankind mind. It will come, it will stay for a while, and then it will go. And that is the nature of everything in this room. It's ephemeral. It's up, present, and then changes into something else. What emotion have you ever had that's lasted until today? With the same intensity, the same degree, static and never changed. Yet we're afraid of that. And what we do is we locate ourselves on one continuum or component of this space and say, I am an angry person. I am a sorrow person. I am a depressed person. Because occasionally that emotion will come into our life. Not consistently. But we so define ourselves by that one quality that we give that quality a charge that far exceeds its importance or its duration. Can we just allow things to come through this mind, be present, show themselves, feel it fully? I'm not asking for detachment or certainly not disassociation. Feeling it fully, fully. Being very intimate with what it is that we're experiencing in this moment, intimately. Because awareness doesn't back you away. Awareness brings you very close to. If I can just feel, okay, I can feel this. Remember the mantra, it's okay to feel this. It's okay to feel this. No, just make sure it doesn't run out. It's okay to feel this. Now I'm going to ask you for your first homework, for you to pick an emotion which you have a troubling relationship with. Does anyone need one assigned? And when that emotion comes up in the course of this week, I would like you to apply that simple mantra. First, if you have the opportunity to sit down and just be with yourself or get away and be alone, fine. If you don't, at least apply this mantra. It's okay to feel this. If you have the opportunity to sit down, okay, it's okay to feel this. And just allow the mind to be spacious, to see and to feel completely what it is that you're feeling, but not to hold it off or try to distance yourself or to try to get rid of it or to try to change it in any way whatsoever. For all you're doing is trying to feel it. And you'll notice, clock it. See how long it lasts. Now, it'll go much quicker if you don't foster and feed the content. The content, which parallels the emotional, physical sensation, is the component part of the mood that rationalizes or blames the emotion upon something, thereby increasing its intensity and its duration. If you just release yourself from the content, what you're actually doing is being much more responsible for the actual emotion itself, which is ours to be accountable to. No one's doing it to us. And the explanations or the rationale or the content, all that tries to do is to have a give us an escape clause. Oh, it's because of him or her. Or it's because my mother. But if we just hold the emotion, feel it for what it is, experience in it, you can clock it. How many seconds? Or maybe it's a minute, or maybe it's 5 minutes. Doesn't matter, it's going to end. You can clock it. It's okay to feel this. So that's the first homework assignment, okay? Now I want to bring forth very strong conditioned tendencies that come into everybody's room. Not just your room, but every single person. These tendencies are so strong that in Buddhism they're called the five hindrances. The five hindrances. These are patterns that are encased in our conditioning. And we are puppets to them. When they show up, we act them out. What you'll begin to find is that no emotion creates the action unless it's being identified with and not completely observed. Once you've taken it from the back where subconsciously it's driving you and you've recognized it and allowed it in your lap where you can see it, you have taken its ability to control you out, off. The needle is off the record. That's an old metaphor. The disc has stopped turning. And these five hindrances have a very enormous conditioned reference to them. So I'll go through them. Now what I want you to do, if you will, for this week is to include them in your meditation practice. When you see them come in, recognize first and most importantly that they are present in your meditation and in your life. So you can feel them, okay. They're there. What's the first hindrance? The first hindrance is desire or wanting, the craving mind, the mind that looks out beyond itself to bring in something into the moment in which I believe the moment needs or is lacking. I'm thirsty, I'm hungry, I'm desirous. The mind that is wanting looks beyond what the immediate reference is in the here and now and creates a future expectation for that moment to evolve into another moment that will be far better because it will contain the product or the person that I most want. And so it has nothing to do with the here and now. It has everything to do with the future. And as we sit, we can just be wanting the whole time. Gosh, I'd really like to go back and meet that person again or hear that song or play or eat that candy bar or whatever it might be. Wanting will play a major role in everyone's practice, guaranteed. So what we need to do is to know that wanting is occurring, to know that wanting is happening. Oh, wanting, okay, wanting. Label it, wanting, wanting, okay, wanting. And just see it like everything else. That once you stopped enriching the wanting with the content of what you want, then it will fall down in on itself. It will implode. Wanting. Okay. So first we have to know we're wanting. The second hindrance is not wanting. Aversion, fear, annoyance, where what is contained in the immediate moment needs to have some remodeling done. The pain in the knee has to be, we have to eliminate the pain in the knee. We have to eliminate the emotion that is coming. There's an aversive response which creates the relationship for things not to be welcomed within the present moment. And so the present moment may contain some fabric of something that has an unpleasant quality to it, and we bring a whole aversive story to that unpleasant quality and spend our whole practice trying to get over or get out of, or if we're real sophisticated, wait it out, and which is nothing to do with actually seeing it, just shining the light and observing it. It has everything to do with judgment and subtle forms of manipulation. What we're trying to do is to neutralize our relationship so that it doesn't contain an aversive, gotta get rid of you kind of attitude. So we need to be aware of not wanting, aversion. Okay, I'm feeling aversive right now. And you can feel, you'll be able to pick it up, you'll become very sensitive to these things. It's like rubbing your hand over the rug. At first it feels rough, but then you begin to pick up the subtlety of the roughness of the feel. And so too, as you become more sensitive to your inward life, that inward life will show you its texture. You'll be able to pick up aversion or wanting or all of the different things that we're most afraid to. We don't even know there's a mirror in the room, because we can't even locate it to focus on it. We're just in the room thinking, what is this meditation about now? Huh? And then all of a sudden we see there's a mirror in the room. And as our practice focuses and gets a little clearer, it's like we're approaching the mirror. And as we approach the mirror, we begin to see the blemishes, the wrinkles, the age factors, all the things that we wish weren't there. And we see them internally as well. We see the textures that our life runs on, the motivation, the intentions in which we play upon, the greed that really predominates as one of those motivating factors. And as we approach the mirror, we think, this is hideous. I must be the only person to have such a terrible image. And that is one of the ways that we leave meditation behind. We think, oh, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to go out and hide again and pretend like I'm not greedy. Which is what we all do. So we have to be willing, as we approach the mirror, to stay relaxed and to look at the textures and not to be identified with what we see as me or mine. This is very important. This is just the cosmos unfolding within you. This is your inward world of thoughts, ideas that have all been a conditioned references, and they're just like a kaleidoscope. They're just showing themselves in different arrangements moment after moment. We don't have to say, I am anything. You just see it. You just allow it to be what it is. So not identifying with what is in the room is a very important part about being friendly in the room. Being able to sit there and allow things to come, because they don't all have a personal message in which we are the bearer of the truth. It's a little bit like being outside and seeing clouds in the sky. We don't say, I like that cloud, I don't want that cloud. But inside, the internal weather patterns of our mind, we do say that about. And yet they both operate from the same laws of nature. So, the first hindrance is wanting. The second hindrance is not wanting. The third hindrance, I think you'll recognize as sleepiness, sloth and torpor, it's called. Dullness of mind. Anybody not recognize that one? If you've been sitting, you're probably already very familiar with that. And you have probably blamed your meditation or, oh, I got up too early or something. And you remember the first homework that I gave everyone was to get 8 hours sleep. So that at least gives you the basis on which you can have some stability of energy. But then, because for so many different reasons we get tired. Sometimes we get tired because we have learned that when you sit down, you close your eyes, you turn down the lights, you have no stimulation, you're supposed to go to sleep. So we have to retrain ourselves to stay awake under those conditions. We can also get tired because as we sit, our consciousness and unconsciousness is releasing perhaps certain memories, certain things are coming up. And those memories can be intimated before they actually are perceived. And when they are sensed, the mind can make itself very dull so that it won't have to feel what it thinks or senses might be arising within it. So sleepiness can be a defense against some of the sharp qualities of our consciousness that do arise. But mostly, sleepiness is just a state of waxing and waning energy that every one of us go through. After you eat a meal, you're going to be sleepy. So we have to be willing to feel sleepiness as a state. Okay, I can feel this. What's it feel like to be sleepy? What's the body feel like when it's tired? The moment that I bring some clarity and awareness to the sleepiness, it'll often dissipate just in my resolve not to follow the pattern, but to watch it and to see it for what it is. For every one of these hindrances are only hindrances when they are not seen. When they are seen and incorporated within one's practice, they actually feed the strength of the practice itself. So that's the third hindrance. The fourth hindrance is the hindrance of restlessness, turbulence, worry. Many people will come up to me and say, you know, I'm a more active person than this practice. I usually say to them, does that mean you can't sit still? Don't you want to be able to sit still? Is anyone so active that they can't sit still or they can't learn to sit still? What about when you wait for a bus? What about when you die? Are you going to be able to dance yourself to death? You see, we have to learn how to be quiet and still. We have to have some reference to stillness in ourselves. And we have to be able to include restlessness within that stillness. Listen to what I said there. Not in opposition to the stillness, but when we are aware of restlessness, the awareness is stillness seeing restlessness. Because the light isn't moving, you're moving within the light. And so when I'm aware of restlessness, I'm bringing stillness. I'm bringing the quality of stopping to the agitation and worry. And we begin to understand through that, because awareness shows us what that state is. What we usually do is identify with the state so strongly that we don't even reference it as being seen. But when our intention is to see it, then we begin to discern what it really is. And when we discern what it really is, that's called wisdom. That's called wisdom. When you see something rather than play it out. So that's the fourth hindrance. Now the fifth hindrance. The mightiest of the mighty becomes the throne monarch better than the crown. That is doubt. Mostly self-doubt. And the reason that doubt has such a hold and an empowerment over us is that it pulls the energy out from any attempt. I can't do it. Cuts ourselves off from any energy or effort whatsoever. I can't do this. And we so easily say that because we think that we're the only one who has a faltering and inability to focus. It's not true. Often in the third week, I have to kind of pump the students up. They were energetic for the first week, but there was a hole in the balloon soon after. And when we get to the third week, it's like, oh man, this is hard. I didn't want to do this. And we were almost deflated. So I want to pump you up a little and say absolutely that everyone is going through what you go through after 3 weeks of practice. That this is just the course that it takes. That please don't give up. Don't say I can't. Just continue with it. Continue with it and you'll find that you'll start pumping the thing back up and filling the holes. The holes were the hindrances that you didn't know how to fill. Now I'm showing you how to fill the, so when the balloon starts leaking, you put your thumb on the balloon hole and you can blow yourself up. Enough of that analogy. Wasn't working, but. Even the Buddha went through this. Look, in the course of 2,500 years of history in this tradition, what it's done towards the benefit of humankind. May I join that benefit as well. I have to put it in, and I have to be willing to face what my mind brings up as objections to putting in my time, because it will object. It will do everything it can to get you off the cushion. Because it does not want to be seen. The mind does not want to see itself. It wants to perpetuate the illusion that the problems are external. It does not want to own and be accountable and be responsible for itself. And so much of what we're talking about are mind strategies to get you off the cushion. So doubt is a big one. It's because we have lived in a culture of comparison and contrast. We have fostered doubt within ourselves, and it's ready and willing to come out. And as soon as we have a task that's a least bit hard, and we sense that's going to be an even path that we walk on with a lot of difficulty, I'm out of here. Already 20 of you have stopped coming. Already. How many more in the next 2 or 3 weeks? Most of which have left because of self-doubt. To know that we're doubting, to know that, okay, and to take the enormous step of courage to say, okay, I can be okay, I can feel this doubt. Let me not follow doubt as the critical factor in my life from henceforth. Let me not die with doubt. Let me stand, okay, I can feel this. Doubt. And slowly the confidence from self-knowledge begins to form. And we begin to walk with unshakability from that confidence. That's within each one of our ability. Knowing the five hindrances, being aware that they're there, not identifying them as mere mind, not judging them, but just allowing them to be a part of our meditation and being able to focus and attend to them when they do arise. Include them in the space and the dimensions of the room and relax, because your life is being cared for far beyond your ability to care for it. Great winds are pushing you along in this life, despite your objections. And we begin to touch those great winds when we step out of the personalization of each and everything being my fault. And may you all grow. Can we be quiet for just a minute? So we're back from the walking meditation, and I want to give you a chance to ask as many questions tonight as you would like, and I also want to explain about your homework and some of the other things, okay? So let me take this point just to talk to you. I would suggest a book to buy to sort of as the textbook of this class, if you so wish. It's called The Beginner's Guide to Insight Meditation. It's by Arina, A-R-I-N-N-A, Wiseman, W-E-I-S-M-A-N. And it's just a really thorough, basic primer to what we're doing here and why we're doing it, and I think it would be very helpful. for you. So if you're interested, you can come up and look at this book afterwards. And she's a teacher friend and who comes up to this area quite often. So we have mentor lists. If the mentor list would be placed out on the table with a couple of pins. Mentors are people who have had 5 or more years of experience who attend the Monday night groups, who are willing and available for you to sign up next to their name, and only one mentor to one student. And it's up to you to copy down your mentor's number and to contact him or her. But they are there, they know you're going to call, and they're very willing to speak to you about the meditation, go out to, and get a coffee with you or something, spend some time. They're very willing, and if you sign up and you don't go, you're just kind of wasting that person's availability. So please do sign up. We encourage you to. There are a number of people there who are available, and those lists will be on the table there at the end of this session, and I'll bring them next week too. And you can just, where it says, like Ellen is one of them, you just across from Ellen, you write your name and your phone number and take down her phone number, and then you can give her a call. So does everybody understand the mentor list? Okay. That's really a nice service because you have somebody else available to support you. And once this series of class ends, and if you'd like to come to the Monday night, you'll know somebody there, and it'll be that much more inviting to you. It's not cliquish anyway, but it is nice to have some familiarity with someone. You got your directions to Bastyr. Those are the blue sheets. Keep those with you because that will be where we will have our day long. Homework. As I mentioned, it's okay to feel this. You have your emotion, right? Shake your head so that I know you're with me. Okay, good. You have your emotion. It's okay to feel this, okay? Now, the homework that I gave you in the handout, I'd like you to take 1 hour sometimes during the course of the week when you have an hour of available time and do nothing but try to be mindful for that hour. No, exactly. You don't have to just sit. I'm not asking you to sit for that hour. I'm asking you to, you can do whatever you want to, mow the grass or wash dishes or whatever. But your primary purpose is not to complete the task. It's to be mindful throughout the duration of that time. So the figure ground is switched. Mostly we try to complete the task, and mindfulness is the secondary quality that we might bring to it, but mostly we forget. So now this is the mindfulness, is what the point of the hour is, and the task is secondary. You can walk around or take a walk or go out in the park and just keep reframing everything you're doing. Oh, come back to mindfulness, just as you would while you're sitting. And this is to break the habit of thinking that mindfulness is just on the cushion. What we're trying to do is to give you some sense that you can know what you're doing, be grounded in your body, and have the physical component experience no matter what you're doing, washing dishes, etc. Okay? So take that particular exercise seriously. 1 hour, uninterrupted mindfulness. And if your life just cannot give you an extra hour, what are you doing here? This is 2 hours. I'm just joking. Find a half an hour. Now, if I start off and say that, everybody will say, "Oh, yeah, I can only do a half an hour." Do an hour, okay? All right, do an hour. Another marker. Do I have to explain anyone to what a marker is? Everyone know what a marker is? Okay. Yes. You don't know what a marker is? No. A marker is an activity which we established on the first week where we create a pause from something we do, like putting ignition key in the, okay? We put your ignition key in the, and then you pause, and then you drive, turn on, it takes like 10 or 15 seconds, and then you drive from that pause, from that sense of collectedness. And so we're on marker number 3. This is the third week. We're on marker number 3. Okay? Like a really good marker is every time you hear a bell, your phone rings. Don't go rushing to catch it on the first ring. Pause, let it ring once or twice, and then from a sense of collectedness, go pick up the phone from that, you see? Or the doorbell rings. Oh, you know, just pause. And then walk mindfully to the door so you can open and greet whoever is there from that sense of pause. See how those can work? Okay. Anybody want to share any of their markers? Yes.
When was before I turned the computer on at work?
Oh, beautiful. Before she turned the computer on at work. So that happens, you know, okay, so, and then push the button, bling, and then you're engaged, right? Okay, good. Nice one. Anyone else want to share? Yes.
Eating,
sitting down at the table. What do we think grace is? Grace is a marker. Well, it's always meant to be a marker. Before you start gobbling, just take time, pause. Everybody will think that you're really holy. Good one. Anyone else? Okay. So those are the things I wanted to talk about. Now I want to open it up to questions from anyone about anything, and I don't want you to pretend like it's all going well if it's not. You can, yes, in the back.
I have Vipassana, is that how you pronounce it?
Vipassana.
Vipassana. I have a Vipassana book by S.N. Gonka.
Yes.
I believe it's a beginner's kind of book.
Yes.
Would that book be adequate or helpful in place of the book you just recently suggested?
Are you trying to save yourself some money? You can read whatever you'd like to read. S.N. Goenka's book, the question was whether a book by Goenka would be comparable to this book. Goenka is a Vipassana teacher. He has a different style of Vipassana. He does sweeping physical sensations and sweeping meditation. What we're doing is we're including not only physical sensations, but the whole range and presentation of mind itself. So you won't find that in that reading. So that's the reason I'm suggesting reading that parallels our particular style. Okay? So that's the, yeah. Yes?
You said earlier that judgment, you were talking about judgment from the interview of our mind. You said that judgment comes from within.
Yes.
But I don't quite understand that because I see that judgment also has a really strong external source.
But the question is that I talked about judgment is coming from within, and this woman says that she feels very strong judgment from external force. But so what? So if I'm sitting here judging you, so what? How does that affect you? Except if you assume my judgment, which is a judgment from you. If I sit here and judge you... So what? See, that's important to know this. You have that has no bearing on you whatsoever. Except if you pick it up and think, oh, he's judging me. I can tell by the way crossway he's or she's looking at me. Now I've got to change. And that internal, then we're all off kilter, which is our own judgment. If I just, I don't really care too much whether you're judging me or not. If we genuinely, it's not because I don't care about you, it's just that your judgments are your own mind, and God, I have enough to deal with in my own mind. So for me to assume your insanity on top of my own doesn't make a lot of sense. So we're going to learn, and that's really the topic next week, of how we really discern what's in us and what's in that other person, and how we confuse the two issues. Judgment comes from within us, right? So let's be very clear on that. And we can find that judgment and notice it in its frequency. We're judging lots. We're judging almost continuously, if we want to be honest. Yes?
Speaking of judgment, if you think that you did an exceptionally bad job with the second marker, do you want us to move forward with the third marker?
Question is whether this person did an exceptionally bad job with the first marker, whether I'd want her to move on to the second. Why don't you go back and re-own the second one and work with that? We're not task-centered here, okay? We're really process-centered. So you go at your own pace, and make it come alive to you. Huh? Make your whole life come alive to you. It's not a check-off list as much as it's an invitation to become alive. Huh? Okay, good. Yeah. Yes.
Can you speak to self-consciousness?
Yes.
I've been feeling self-conscious and I spent my whole life trying not to be self-conscious.
So. Right. So the question is around self-consciousness. Could I speak to that? Well, the moment that you actually start bearing attention to yourself, it feels a little weird. In fact, when in walking meditation, when we start doing that, we lose balance often. And it's like, I used to do it so easily, now I can't even walk anymore. This is supposed to be a helpful meditation. But the point is that is a temporary phase of the meditation. And what the meditation will do is lead us out of self-consciousness so that we have a center of knowing what's going on in us and a discernibility to know what's coming at us and to be able to discern between those two. It's not to whitewash the fact that you don't care about anybody, but again, it's not to take up their projections as something you have to live by, which is what self-consciousness is. You think somebody's looking at you and that you have to abide with the reference of what they're thinking.
With me, it's more, I'm uncomfortable watching myself.
Oh, she's uncomfortable.
I'm not taking on other people's side, but okay. Feeling like I'm outside the situation and not
okay. Just being in the situation. So that's a phase. It's a phase of the practice, that sense of watching. Okay, it's a phase. Put up with the phase. Put up with the phase. Yes. Yes.
So part of my question I think was answered in your earlier talk, but I'm getting confused about how to stay focused while paying attention to all these different aspects. So, for example, I'm attending to my breath, and then my back is hurting, so then I move away from that into my body, and I'm still in my body, I'm jumping all over my body. It's not just my back. It's like, you know, here and there and everywhere. And then, you know, from there onto this feeling level thing.
So then
I'm like kind of feeling like I'm just spinning right back to the beginning, which is where.
Okay. So the question is, how to maintain a focus as we have increased the field of our attention to include more and more sensation. I want you to pick just one sensation, and I want you to stay at that predominant sensation. Don't go scrambling the light all over the room. Stay with the breath, and when you feel relatively able to move out to something, then stay with that something else. And then just because something else comes up, you don't go there. Don't jump around like a jelly bean, a jumping bean. Don't jump around. Just stay with one sensation. And it may be that you'll want to stay with your breath the whole time. Right?
Even if my back is really...
Then take your attention and place it on your back. And stay there the whole time. Alright? Then if you get very, very upset and angry at your back being hurting, notice the anger. And then come back to the back.
Okay, because that's actually what happens.
Yeah. Right. That's called anger. Right. So we have goddamn back. Yes. Yes. Okay. So you want to, first of all, relax. So you see, I'm telling you a lot of things and you've got to practice them. It's like skiing. Keep your weight forward. It's like all these things. And then you just fall down. Right? So we're falling down a lot. But that's okay. Everybody falls down early on. So we're learning a whole system and a whole strategy that's very foreign to us. So give yourself plenty of opportunity to make mistakes, to fall down, to get upset, to be annoyed, and to return again, to come back again. Be very patient in this process. Just stay with us, right? Okay, stay with us, and just stay with one object. If you're getting annoyed with it, just stay with the predominant object and don't go anywhere else. Okay? Okay, good. Yes?
When doing mindfulness, does it have to be the same thing each time? Like, I'll just start out with a brushing your teeth. Does it have to stick with that each time? Is that your like number one? Or like what I've been doing is sometimes just during the day I'll call it, this is my marker.
The question is whether you have to stay with the same marker each day or whether you can just form the markers as the day unfolds. What a marker is a conditioned reference to doing something repetitively so that you start charging the activity with the pause and the mindfulness. If you just pick it out as it comes up in the course of the day, you won't have enough repetition to bring that mindfulness to bear upon that when you do it. But if you stick your key in every single day into your car and pause, long after these 6 weeks are over, there's going to be some resonance of pause with that. Yeah, so that's what the marker's for. Good. In the back there? No, I got the question. The question is if she's meditating and her leg goes to sleep and she then begins to notice her leg going to sleep, when does she move it? And is there a point where it's beneficial to move it as opposed to... I haven't heard anyone damaging themselves from a leg going to sleep. Okay, so you can stay for a while with that. If it gets too irritating to you and a lot of fear comes up, then just change your position. Go sit in a chair, do something like that, and that's fine. There are times when we sit and we're actually maybe sitting that is causing a problem, a long-term problem. But the way you'll know that is when you get up, whatever it is that the irritation that accompanied the sitting will dissipate very quickly within the first minute after you get up. If it persists longer than that, then you might be sitting wrong and sitting and creating a problem rather than just allowing the problem to arise. So just begin to notice whether that sense of the leg going to sleep. Mostly our leg going to sleep is a very common experience as the ligaments and tendons begin to stretch according to the posture we're taking. So it's not uncommon, but it should dissipate pretty quickly once you get up. Someone who hasn't asked a question? Yes. What kinds of things can the mentor help you with? One thing is that they can give you assurance that beyond just my word, and somebody who is not that far, doesn't have that much more experience than you, 5 years, and someone who can show you and tell you, yes, this is something that I went through too, and yes, and this is what I did, and get together with you and just give you some sense that of support through these very difficult and laborious training. It's very difficult to do. And to do it by oneself when you don't have to just seems a little bit more laborious to me. So they can just be a support system to you. Somebody you can talk to on the phone, call and say, I just had a terrible meditation. You know, something just to share with you. You can use them in lots of different ways. Yes?
Can you speak about the quality of the breath and what happens to it from the time you sit, begin to sit until you finish? It seems to change for me a lot.
The question is about the breath and whether it seems to change as the duration of the sitting increases. It will change often according to the emotion you're feeling. If there's fear, it'll change. First of all, if the body's relaxed, it becomes very settled. And as you become more and more refined in your noticing of the breath, it will become almost whisper-like in its quality. And sometimes it'll feel like it disappears completely, almost feathery-like. Sometimes it'll take different tones and different durations. And all you are is, your job is not to try to make it a certain way, but just to notice the way it is. Okay? So that's a very important, that you're not trying to make it very subtle or not. Just noticing when it's not subtle and noticing when it's subtle. Okay? Do you have a question?
I find myself challenged by the hindrance of desire. And wanting to set up dreams and goals, but also be in the moment to allow your life to unfold? I know that's a pretty big question, but...
Right. The question is about desire and setting goals and intentions. I think goals and setting goals, long-term goals, are very important. And I don't think that that is what I'm talking about. If I can just show you what I... For instance, I may have a long-term goal of going to school and finishing a degree or something. So I have that and I work according to that. But that doesn't have to consume my anxiety and worry. I can just move towards the activities that allow that goal to be completed without creating some sense of inward turmoil and tension around that goal. What we're interested not so much is in the goal setting, it's in the attitudes that we come and bear to that goal. And that's where the desire gets out of control and too rampant. Do you see?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Could you just review quickly the walking meditation?
The what?
The walking meditation.
Could I review the walking meditation? The walking meditation is only... What it is we're, instead of focusing on our breath or some other competing sensation, we're focusing on the sensation of our feet as they move in our walking. As they shift, as they lift, as they move, as they place themselves on the floor, there's a sensation that accompanies that movement. And what that does is that it begins to allow us to experience mindfulness in movement as opposed to just sitting still and breathing. And once that link is firmly embedded within us, we can be doing many different kinds of activities, like washing dishes, and we find that we can couple that activity with mindfulness because we have practiced the walking. So the walking has an immediate effect upon how it is and what it is that we can be mindful of in motion, in movement. Yes. Question is a question of self-doubt about whether someone can actualize mindfulness. I would suggest, rather than setting up some kind of standard or ideal that we cannot live up to, just taking ourselves where we are and beginning the process. As soon as you create an ideal, you create a separation between yourself and that ideal and all the anxiety and desire to cross that cavern to get to the other side. And really, that's not what the point is. The point of mindfulness is to take us home, to be at home with ourselves. Okay. And if we do it for 1 minute, we've done it for 10,000 years. Okay. Because every moment is complete in and of itself. It doesn't have to do with how much time it's okay, let me be here. And it starts feeding on itself because it's nourishment. It gives you back something that your heart most craves, and that is a sense of being at the vortex of your aliveness, as opposed to casting that aliveness off in terms of worry or stress or remorse and shame. It allows us to stay front and center on the stage where we are alive, at the point of that juxtaposition. And that begins to have its own reinforcement. And so it's not like a burden anymore. It becomes something that feeds us in doing. And we begin then to lead with mindfulness rather than to lead with the worries of the day. But we have to break the patterns of the worry to let mindfulness in. And so what we're doing in this course is just beginning to notice some of the many patterns that cross-reference us away from our being able to be here now. And as soon as we get a hold on that, then we can find ourselves sitting here and now, even as those patterns try to pull us off. And we are unmoved by the pull of that conditioning. Yes.
Does that come in meditation, or does that come outside of meditation?
The question is about entering the room of the mind, which was the talk tonight. Does that come in meditation or does that come outside of meditation? It comes as we practice it all the time, because the purpose of mindfulness is to take us into ourselves so that we know what the room is doing to us, what we're feeling, what we're thinking, what sensations are occurring, what attitudes we're holding. All of that can be known as we go through a very busy day. We sit in order to generate the qualities of mind and heart that allow us to cultivate that in and out of sitting. Sitting is a very refined and purposeful activity, or inactivity, you might say, that has the intention of establishing that inward direction so that it gives us some local location so that we can then move with that reference throughout the day. It doesn't mean that we stay inward and we can't greet people because we're too focused inward. But we also, as we greet people, know, like right now, I'm very inward and I'm answering this question. I'm not thinking about how I'm going to answer this question. I know what I'm feeling. I know I'm sitting here on the chair. I know I feel my body. And I'm answering the question. And it doesn't keep me in any way from answering the question and knowing what I'm experiencing as I do it. You see? So that keeps any projection from forming. It keeps me from losing myself in the conversation. It keeps me from becoming egocentric in the conversation and just form, you know, and all that, right? It just keeps me going. So that is available as we practice and over the course of our time. Last question. Yes. Achieve?
Well, work towards.
Work towards what?
Meditation or release from activity.
So the question is?
Well, I'm wondering if that would be an acceptable pose versus the sitting.
Oh. You want to lie down.
Well,
question.
Why I asked is because injury in my back and it's sitting for a long time.
Okay. Right. That's, I understand. So the question is whether the corpse pose is a legitimate form of sitting. The Buddha said you can meditate walking, lying down, standing up. Walking, lying down, standing up, seated. He said, I don't know, or sitting. Thank you. You can practice mindfulness lying down. What's the hindrance that's going to occur when that happens? That's right, sleepiness. And so you have to be very careful of sleepiness. But if you have a chronic back problem and you can't sit up, then lying down is perfectly appropriate. And it's even appropriate in here. Just come see me, because I don't want to misrepresent why you're lying down. I don't want you to be lazy in this, but I want you to accommodate whatever chronic conditions you might have. Okay? And it can be done. It just needs more vigilance. Okay, good. So I want to thank you all this evening. It's been a very nice class, and I look forward to seeing you the next time you come. If you would please remember the Dana, because it is the source of my livelihood, and I very much appreciate your generosity. Thank you.